Welcome to the April 2015 issue of Dialogues in Dermatology. The American Academy of Dermatology is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. The American Academy of Dermatology designates this enduring material for a maximum of 2 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. Physicians should claim only the credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in the activity. Participation in this activity is completed by listening to dialogues on CD or a downloaded MP3 file, achievement of a 70% or higher score on the post-test, and completion of an activity evaluation. The date of original release for this issue is April 2015. The expiration date is March 2018. At the conclusion of this learning activity, participants should be able to identify strategies to provide cost-effective care to dermatology patients, discuss key business management principles that support successful practice management, and identify strategies to ensure pertinent information is communicated to the dermatopathologist when sending biopsy specimens. Contributors to this issue of Dialogues in Dermatology have disclosed the following financial relationships. Dr. Stuart Brown is a stockholder and receives stock from Johnson & Johnson Consumer Product Company and Pfizer, Inc. Dr. Laura McGirt is a consultant for and receives fees from DePuy Orthopedics, Inc. Dr. Kevin Kia is a consultant for and receives honorarium from Castle Biosciences, Inc. All other contributors, including editors, interviewees, reviewers, and staff, reported they have no relevant relationships with commercial interests. A comprehensive list of disclosed financial relationships is available in the syllabus.
Welcome back to Dialogues in Dermatology. This is Terry Cronin, your editor-in-chief. This is Dialogues in Dermatology for April 2015, Volume 71, Issue Number 4. I hope you're having another wonderful month and enjoying spring. I want to remind you about the fabulous new Dialogues in Dermatology app for your smartphone and computer. This convenient app is making dialogues even more accessible and enjoyable while effectively providing CMEs for you. In this month's edition, we have exciting new dialogues on a practice management theme. With the rising healthcare costs for society and the increasing deductibles for patients, it is imperative that physicians consider not only the quality, but also the cost of the care we provide. In this month's issue of Dialogues in Dermatology, Dr. Kevin Kia and Dr. Stuart Brown discuss healthcare costs in dermatology and some pragmatic pearls for lowering the bottom line.
Today we're going to discuss cost-conscious dermatology, and I'm certain that anyone who is new to practice is well aware of it. Certainly their patients are. Kev, how did you get interested in this topic?
So working with the residents at UT Southwestern, I realized there was sort of a practice gap that we had at the university where we were teaching residents incredibly well how to do medical and surgical dermatology. But if you asked a third-year resident about the cost of what they were doing or about what would be cheaper for a patient, there was often a blank stare. And residents were graduating being incredibly good at what they were doing. They just didn't know the impact of what they were doing.
There's no question our residents, when they're finished, they are scary brilliant. But the social aspects, the functional aspects of a practice, they are fully unprepared for.
And the problem when you get on a community practice is you're bombarded by advertisements, by rebate cards, by things that can sometimes mislead you to make you think you're doing a cost-effective approach to something when actually you're spending much more than you ever did before.
When you got interested and found out there was a lacking, where did you go for your sources to find out the answers?
So there's a lot of literature out there about evidence for what we're doing. There's very little out there that's directed at dermatology for cost-effective care in the literature. So a lot of what I had to do was just doing my own research to try and find out what's the data behind what we're actually doing, and then going back and looking at laboratory costs, imaging costs, prescription costs, and trying to gather some information that way. Very little is published. We have lots of guidelines about how to manage patients, but very little attention is actually made to the bottom dollar at the end of it.
So what lit the fire and said, aha, this is it?
Yeah, I think if you're in practice, we're all frustrated by prior authorizations, by people coming back saying they can't afford the prescriptions you have. And so at a certain point, you just are frustrated by what you're prescribing or how the amount of work you have to do to get people your medicine. So trying to realize, well, why are insurance companies blocking what I'm doing? And is there a reason behind why they're blocking? Should I really be fighting for these extra things, or should I be making patients pay if they have a high deductible out of pocket for what I'm asking them to do?
I remember a long time ago when I was a resident, one of the popular medications of the day was sulfacetamide, 10% sodium sulfacetamide. And it came out in several different forms and several different non-generic names. It was very inexpensive. Now, granted, back when I was a resident, the dollar hadn't even been invented yet. So things were a lot cheaper, and the amount of growth in money has changed significantly. But I don't think it changed so much that when the pharmaceutical companies discovered that sulfacetamide hasn't been out on the market for a while, and that each company put it out, some with sulfur, some without, and it was over $100. It was as much as $100.50 in various forms. And it costs about 2 cents a carload, and the bottle might cost even less than that, or the jar or the tube. And it is, to me, to my mind, a ripoff. And I don't know any way around it. I do know this, that some of the medications that I use, I can have compounded. And they can be compounded for a lot less, than the already prepared, such as 5-fluorouracil can be bought for about a third of the price and compounded simply.
I think if you have knowledge and good access to compounding, you can get patients' drugs at a much better rate. When I gave the lecture around this topic at the Academy, several of the people came up at the end and commented on that. I think the average age of the people that commented were somewhat similar to you.
Ancient.
Yeah, because compounding is getting forgotten by the younger generation. And
well, it's not just by the younger generation. It is no longer taught in derm programs. It is no longer taught in pharmacology programs. The pharmaceutical students do not learn compounding. And there are a few pharmacies around every community that specialize in that. It's good to get on good working relationships with them.
Yeah. And I think it, moving forward, it may be more difficult. There's been, everyone knows about recent infections that have happened in compounding pharmacies. So they're getting more and more regulated. And I think they're still a hugely valuable resource. But it may be a day where they become even less and less available to us.
Sadly, over the years of being around, I have never found a right answer. Now, these discussions are primarily of medications. There are a lot of other expensive messages in trying to run a quality practice. What are some other aspects that you ran across?
I think one thing I saw was realizing that there's a lot that when you're evaluating a patient, there's a difference between what you can do and what you need to do. And meaning that if someone presents with a problem, there is a lot that you could theoretically associate with that problem, that you could order to see if there's any associated condition, that you could try to check every lab or further work up the patient. But whether or not that actually is going to affect the patient's outcome is not always the case. I think also when we're training our residents, we're teaching a lot about associations. We're teaching a lot about rare things that can happen, say in patients with hives, rare associations that happen to them. So the residents are very aware of that, whereas they're not necessarily aware of the context of what happens when you start screening everyone for that. So one of the messages I try to deliver is that we don't always necessarily need to be acting for the gold standard of care, meaning that checking every box, doing every single possible thing that you can imagine to work up a patient when really there's probably some fundamental things you need to not miss, and the rest you can sort of not do laboratory testing for.
Well, as we know, by definition, rare diseases are rare. It doesn't mean you shouldn't consider them, but it doesn't mean you have to act upon that.
That's right.
And no one wants to be caught having missed something. That's just not in our nature, or we wouldn't have gotten where we are. And you have to either write no evidence of such and such, which you see in so and so. And those things, I think, carry some weight.
Well, one of the issues we have, I think, in the U.S. is that we're trained that we need to do everything, and that without doing everything, we're going to be giving bad care to the patient. Whereas in other countries that deliver fairly good quality of care to patients, the extent of the workup, the extent of treatment is often a lot less than what is done in the United States with very good outcomes.
That's the difference between a great clinician and an excellent clinician. Kevin, let's take one of our commonest problems, acne. Now, some of the acne preparations are exorbitant, and some of them are replicative. What is your approach to try to minimize the cost and still get some quality results for somebody who has previously tried the things that you see at 3 o'clock in the morning on the TV for acne?
One of the surprising things about acne is if you really dive into what you're prescribing and look at the cost of what you're prescribing, I think it's amazing to see that some of our topical therapies that we write on an everyday basis, sometimes 10, 15 times a day, range in the $200 to $400, $500 range for a 60-gram tube or a large tube supply of it. In my experience, the what you prescribe has less to do with efficacy as compliance in acne. So I spend much more time figuring out ways to get patients compliant with a less expensive therapy than I do in prescribing multiple more expensive therapies.
One of the ways to check compliance is ask them to bring it back to make sure that they got what you had prescribed, because sometimes they won't. That's not why you're looking. You're looking to see how much of it's been used.
Asking them to come back has been the biggest thing that I've seen has helped in my response rates in acne. And when I first started practice, I was not seeing my acne patients back with any regular frequency. I was sort of prescribing a treatment plan, sometimes even giving them a secondary backup if it failed, and then seeing them back if it was not responding. And it was almost because there was just this large number of acne patients, and how many can you really see back? And I've learned over the years that actually instilling one or two short interval office return visits in the next 3 or 4 weeks, your compliance rates go up dramatically. And actually prescribing very, very similar medicines to what they may have already come to you on, but just having a short interval follow-up with them, I look like the hero. I look like I've treated their acne when all I've done is gotten compliance to go up.
Kevin, I can support that because I have seen so often residents will delay that follow-up appointment. We'll see you in 6-8 weeks. And the patient with acne wants it gone yesterday. It can't be done. But if you can get them back in 3 weeks, they're not tired of the regimen yet. They haven't gotten flustered enough to say, okay, it's not working, I'm going to quit. What you do, you get them in and you point out these little collarettes of scale around the papules that are melting down, the lack of intense erythema. These are all good signs. To them, they just see, I still got zits. And that is so helpful and reinforcing. And the patients earn the longer follow-up visit depending upon how well they're doing.
I think it also is a good way to manage the often irritation reaction that people get from topicals, especially with benzoyl peroxide, that sometimes that irritation is why they're not using the medicine, even though they're telling you they're using the medicine. So if you can catch them in that window when they may still be red and kind of adjust what they're doing as far as moisturizers, washing, things like that, you can then get them to keep staying on the medicine, which is going to improve your outcome a lot more.
Yes, if you want to watch a benzoyl peroxide patient get redder and redder, keep putting it on red skin. One of the common problems we run into, more so in moms of pediatric patients, is the use of steroids. The word steroids is in neon, in capital letters, with quotes, punctuation marks, and it draws a ferocious response.
I think it's something you really have to address early on, especially when you're giving your treatment plan. You can sometimes just see the look in the parent's eye. If the parents are really into it, or if the parents are just all of a sudden their body language changes, I think if you don't address it, they're not going to use it and they're going to come back worse. When patients come back that have already been on topical steroids, you sort of also need to address that these are not cures for what we're doing, and these are things to help get better and then keep you under control.
Marion Sulzberger used to call them morbidostatic agents, which was a delightful description of its use. Are there special arts to finding inexpensive steroids?
I think in my practice, it's incredibly rare that I would ever prescribe a branded topical steroid. So I think in this day and age, for most of what we do, we should be able to find a generic, low-cost topical steroid, both super potency and low potency, that we can get to our patients.
Let's talk a little bit about steroids versus the immune modulators.
So we have a couple to our access right now with tacrolimus and pimecrolimus that we often use in what we would call maybe sensitive areas, such as the face or flexural areas, or in areas that we're worried about atrophy, or areas that we're worried about side effects such as absorption over the eyes. I think we have great data to say that these products are safe. Initially, when they came out, there was black box warnings associated with them that made our prescribing maybe a little bit harder to prescribe them. But we have lots of great data about safety of them now, so they're becoming more and more mainstream for people to prescribe them. One of the things that I have a problem with them is their costs are so much higher than the equivalent efficacy of a topical steroid. And what I've learned over the last, by doing some of this literature search, is that a lot of the reported problems that we would see by using a steroid in these areas are much less common than we would ever think. And so we've been trained to use some of these non-steroidal medicines in areas that we worry about steroid side effects, but the actual risk of our steroid side effects are really low in some of these areas.
I remember when the pediatricians were enthralled that we had the TIMS come out because they didn't have to fear steroids.
I think steroid phobia is real among patients, and it's also real among practitioners.
Yes, but more so the pedies, because I've done a lot of pediatric derm, did it at Children's for a number of years and so forth. And then when the black box warning came out, the doctors were thrilled because they didn't have to prescribe the TIMS anymore. Now they could go back to steroids, which they had fear of to start with.
Yeah, I'm hoping that as generics become available of, say, tacrolimus, that costs will go down significantly, because I think they do have a role. But right now, we need to be really aware of how much we're spending on those versus a low-potency steroid that would probably give you the same efficacy.
Do you have any magic to help patients handle the burning that they get with the TIMS?
Well, I'm trying to make them not prescribe these. So I do want to talk about, like, people prescribe them to prevent eczema flares.
Yes.
And prescribing steroids instead of that for eczema flares.
I like it. I still think with the many, many, many years of steroids in various strengths, we seem to handle it pretty well. A far lesser amount of experience have we with the TIMS.
That's right. I think if you look back on your patients, the amount of atrophy that you see on a daily basis is actually relatively low compared to the amount of topical steroids you prescribe, and probably relatively low compared to your feeling of what you would see. One of the reasons that the tacrolimus is prescribed a lot is to prevent eczema from flaring in both kids and adults. And we have really great data from very large studies to show that if you apply tacrolimus twice a week, you can actually prevent eczema from flaring. And I think it's been a very helpful tool in that. I think it's been forgotten because a lot of these steroids have now gone generic and they're not advertising this anymore. But we have excellent data that very potent steroids twice a week can be fairly safe, meaning very low chance of atrophy, and also just as efficacious in preventing eczema flares.
Aside, we've also found that applies to isotretinoin, where using a small dose a couple of times a week can maintain the integrity that you were looking for. I personally have done it in people who are on stage and the hot lights give them this horribly greasy look. For news broadcasters on television, a small dose a couple of times a week, very, very beneficial.
I think if we did not have the eye pledge and the other requirements associated with this, that practice would be much more common in the United States. When you think about how much antibiotics we pump out versus the benefit of that for long-term management of acne, and then you think about the benefit of just a very low dose of isotretinoin, like you say, a few times per week, the amount of improvement you would get is much higher with isotretinoin. But you know, the fact that we have this system in place in the United States, it makes it difficult to prescribe.
One of the problems that every dermatologist has, not counting warts, is urticaria. Now, we're talking about cost-conscious medicine. How widely or how intensively do you go after urticaria? Now, let's not just take an acute urticaria. We're taking one that's been there longer than 6 weeks.
That's right. So if you have the patient that comes to you with chronic urticaria, I think it's a frustrating condition because the patients want an answer. Something probably is triggering it, but we don't know. And it's frustrating as a practitioner because you'd like to give them an answer for what's triggering it, but you don't know. And what we've learned, I think, from many years of looking at different associations and underlying causes is that we really don't know what's causing chronic urticaria, and everything we're doing to test for it does not have an impact on the outcome of the urticaria. So in my practice, and what I advocate is really not testing and not working up chronic urticaria. There are many associations that can be had with it, but aside from a good review of systems and a good history, doing an extensive laboratory workup or workup for associated conditions is actually almost completely useless as far as management of the urticaria. There is some minimal evidence that doing a CBC and a SED rate can kind of catch some of the inflammatory problems that may be associated with, saying, an underlying parasite or having an underlying hematologic malignancy. But everything else that's ever been proposed for testing alongside with urticaria, you may come back with a positive result, but it may not actually impact the care of the patient. One thing that is an exception to that is we know that patients with chronic urticaria are more at risk for autoimmune diseases. So I do, whether it's with a good review of systems or ask them to make sure it's included with their annual physical, to think about thyroid function testing. Not necessarily thyroid antibodies, but just thyroid testing. Not in the sense that I think that thyroid disease causes urticaria, but that there's a high percentage of association between patients who have chronic urticaria who are also have thyroid disease.
Well, Kevin, it has been delightful. I have thoroughly enjoyed our discussion. I think our subscribers will enjoy it. I hope they do.
Stu, thank you for having me.
Acne vulgaris is ubiquitous in dermatology. Accordingly, costs added to acne care have a large impact on our practice and society. A 2015 article reviewing oral antibiotic therapy for acne in adults found that 69% of patients did not have a concurrent topical retinoid as recommended to increase efficacy. It also noted a striking cost difference between a 3 to 6 month course of generic and branded antibiotics of $103.77 and $1,421.61, respectively. In addition to the cost of acne medications, another issue is the patient drug adherence factor. Poor compliance decreases efficacy, which likely ultimately raises costs. A 2013 study found that overall acne drug adherence was 11%. Oral retinoids were most adhered to at 57%. Dr. Kia recommended more frequent follow-up visits, roughly every 3 to 4 weeks at first, to answer questions and promote drug adherence. Also, having the patient bring in the medication itself can help illuminate its frequency of use. Atopic dermatitis is another prevalent dermatologic condition, and Drs. Brown and Kia focused on the role of calcineurin inhibitors in atopic dermatitis maintenance therapy. While there are no head-to-head trials of topical calcineurin inhibitors and topical corticosteroids for preventing flares, existing studies report better efficacy with potent corticosteroids. The increased efficacy and the availability of cheaper generic corticosteroid formulations suggest that if used responsibly, corticosteroids are superior. The clinician does need to be cognizant of the adverse effects of corticosteroids and use steroid-sparing agents when necessary. Psoriasis, its comorbidities, and expensive biologic therapies are another area that especially warrant further investigation into evidence-based cost analysis. In 2013, the direct costs of psoriasis are estimated at $51.7 to $63.2 billion. Indirect costs were roughly half of that. The 2010 estimated per-patient cost of maintenance therapy on biologics per year is $26,708. We are fortunate to have new psoriatic therapeutics entering the market. These should be coupled with ongoing review of efficacy and cost.